Hello, I'm Dr. Stephen Hassan with another episode of The Influence Continuum. And I've been looking forward to this very special interview for many months now, because for me, as many of my listeners know, I have an abiding deep interest in hypnosis and altered states of consciousness, and not only the negative undue influence pieces, but also the beneficial pieces. So I've done a number of other interviews. Today, I feel very grateful to Julie H. Linden. Julie's a clinical psychologist. She's the past president of the International Society of Hypnosis, which I am a member of. You are past president of the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis, which I also belong to. Julie is amazing. She's co-authored a book with my good friend Lawrence Sugarman, Changing Minds with Clinical Hypnosis, Narratives and Discourse for a New Healthcare Paradigm, which we have a blog and interview with Lawrence about. But Julie, you are the editor-in-chief of an amazing new volume. I'm going to hold it up in a minute, but I'm just reading. You are the editor-in-chief of the Routledge International Handbook of Clinical Hypnosis with other editors Giuseppe De Benedettis, Lawrence Sugarman, and Catalin Varga. This is the work of years of effort. It's the Routledge International Handbook of Clinical Hypnosis. This is a tome of wisdom and knowledge and information. And Julie, before we get going a little bit more, I just want to read a little bit from Andrew Weil, who's a famous health integrative MD. He says, "This handbook presents the cutting edge of research, theory, and practice that underlies why and how clinical hypnosis is crucial to integrative healthcare. The editors have gathered the research data and broad-ranging experiences from many international experts to bring our understanding of therapeutic communication, which is the core of clinical hypnosis, into the 21st century and beyond." And he says, "I consider this the essential compendium of the field." And Julie, I'm very grateful you and Lawrence asked me to contribute two chapters on the dark side of hypnosis, which I did with my dear friend Alan Shefflin, law professor emeritus, who unfortunately passed away last year, but not before he completed these chapters with me on the dark side of hypnosis. But back to your life work of helping people to heal and research and teach. And my podcast listeners are fascinated to learn about healthy influence. And that's what I believe clinical hypnotherapy is all about. So with that long intro, I'd like to welcome you to the Influence Continuum, Dr. Linden.
Stephen, thank you for that delightful introduction and the invitation to be here. The volume, the heavy tome that you held up, has been several years in the making. This is part of a series that Routledge does every 10 years, and it was exciting to have this opportunity to bring together. There are over 90 contributors in this book. They are from all over the world, and they offer quite a wide range of skills. So we've got theoreticians and researchers and clinicians. And as you know from what you contributed on the dark side of hypnosis, we've really looked at hypnosis from as many different angles and perspectives as we could in this volume. So yes, it's quite exciting.
Yes, and let me tell you, a peer review academic textbook we had a lot of back and forth and revisions. And I'm like, oh my God, these editors, how are they putting up with all of these different contributors? So it really is a labor of love. But let me start, if I may. So how did you get interested in the beginning about hypnosis? Why don't you share a little personal journey story, and then I'd like you to help clarify, what the benefits are of clinical hypnosis, because I've been saying it for years, but I'd love to hear you share.
Well, I'd be happy to. It was sort of serendipity that got me involved. I was a very young psychologist working in Philadelphia at Jefferson's Medical School, their Department of Psychiatry and Human Behavior. And they were looking for a consultant to work with the first burn center that was opening up in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. And they wanted somebody there to address what a very traumatic experience it is for someone to go through a burn. Back then, just getting admitted meant you had been burned over more than 50% of your body. Mm-hmm. I volunteered to go see what it was all about, was very interested, and was lucky enough to be working with someone who was trained in hypnosis, Coco Margolis, who said to me, Julie, if you're going to work with people who have been burned, you've got to learn hypnosis.
Mm.
And I was curious. She proceeded to give us our very first course, and I am forever grateful for having been introduced. You know, when someone has been injured in that way, there's only so much pain medication you can give them. So being able to provide non-medication, but still assist with reducing their experience of pain, was vitally important. And I was going to work with the children who were there. At that time, adults and children were in the same burn center. This young boy had been admitted after a Thanksgiving horrific accident. Mom was taking the Thanksgiving turkey out of the oven, the whole pan, hot oil and all, slipped and fell on her son. Mm. So he was undergoing the treatment procedures, and the nurses were having a terrible time because many people don't know this about burns, but you have to take dead skin away so that the nerves and the skin can regenerate properly. Mm-hmm. And this is called a debridement process. And it was taking them an hour just to calm them down to do what is typically about a 15-minute procedure, at least back then it was.
Are we talking the 70s, Julie? Are we talking the 80s?
We are. Okay. We are talking the 70s.
Get a frame.
Long.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Long time ago. And I met the youngster, found out what he loved to do and where would he like to be if he were not in the hospital. And he wanted to be out playing baseball with his friends. And so with the imagery, I had him out in the baseball field and swinging his bat and just enjoying the outdoors and the success of one home run after another.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he took this experience into the next debridement procedure. I gave him the suggestion he could be out on that baseball diamond and let the hospital stuff fade into the background. Well, they had no difficulty, the nurses, with him. He had his 15-minute procedure and was so excited about all of the home runs he had, right. had hit. And in addition to that, the healing process, and I think you know a little bit about this from your personal experiences, he was able to have full range of motion as the skin was healing because we were able to reduce the scarring because he was actively in his mind moving again, swinging and throwing his baseball, catching the baseball, running out on the field. This was an 11-year-old, by the way, that I was working with. And his mother was, of course, quite grateful and also benefited so that she could be part of his healing process and reduce her guilt about this horrendous accident.
So for my listeners, I just want to state the obvious that we, you and I know, which is when you get burned, it's about the most painful injury you can have. And what you're describing and what I've experienced as well in my own cancer treatment and other things is that we are embodied minds and that this is what's filtering our sensations and such. So if we can engage the mind and not focus on, oh, that hurts in the self-dialogue. Oh, it's excruciating. I hope they don't touch that part. And then it just magnifies it. But if you give people permission, the staff will do what they need to do. And you don't need to be here. You can go to a joyful place and it will speed your body's healing because you will enable the caregivers to help you. So just to be clear, and I've always been saying, and I'll ask you later, but I've always believed a lot of the people who are addicted to opioids, if they were taught pain control through self-hypnosis, they would get off the opioids so much faster and more easily without any detrimental thing. So pain control in particular is one of the really powerful areas of clinical hypnosis. Forgive me for saying so much, but.
No, I appreciate what you said. It was very well said. And in terms of the areas where we know hypnosis is exceedingly effective, pain management is one of them.
Yep.
The other is irritable bowel difficulties. And there's research, prolific research in both of those areas. And the handbook has the latest, most up-to-date research on right. all of that. You know, I want to go back to a point you made, though, that I think is worth repeating. Most people still have to learn how capable their embodied minds are taking care of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, with the with the way that we can talk to ourselves and use our perceptions, we can do a lot to keep ourselves healthy, to heal, and to often augment whatever needs to be done medically or in therapy. You know, hypnosis is something that is used clinically in psychotherapy. It's also used in medical settings. We still live in a world where these are separate, as if our emotions and our mental life were different from what's going on physically in our body. And of course, they're not. But there's a great deal of information now on when we tap into the emotional life and use therapeutic communication effectively Mm-hmm. We change what's going on physically and vice versa.
Yes.
You know, one of the people I was fortunate enough to work with early on at the Burn Center was Dr. Dabney Ewing, who was a burn surgeon.
Yes.
And
I've had trainings with Dabney over the decades.
He was fabulous.
Yeah.
Fabulous gentleman. Because of his own interest in finding ways to help people who had been through these horrible accidents, he stumbled onto hypnosis, learned how to use it, and then got interested in psychiatry and became board certified psychiatrist.
Sure.
Because he knew there was a connection. And sure. Again, this is all going back to the 60s and 70s when he made those changes.
Right. It's fantastic. If I may share a brief personal experience way back, even before I got licensed as a counselor, I had dear friends, Susanna got pregnant, and I was explaining, you know, learning self-hypnosis techniques could really help with childbirth. So I was teaching her breathing and visualization. Well, her water broke. And they summoned me to be by her bedside. And I wound up spending 2 days with her and her husband. And she needed to be in the hospital for a cesarean eventually. But they had a heart monitor and a fetal monitor thing. And in between contractions, I was giving her gentle suggestions, walking in the flower, beautiful fields. And the doctors were amazed how, you know, we've never seen anything like that where it spikes up and then it comes back down. They were amazed. And then in the end, I was in the operating room with the curtain talking to her as Sam was being delivered. I just had dinner with him. He's 39 years old. But it was like one of the most beautiful special experiences of my entire life to witness the birth of a child and to be part of that and making it more natural because she needed a minimum of medication. So I just wanted to share that. I don't do that. And once I got licensed, I was like, no, we have to be more careful about all that. But I was so enthusiastic way back when. But let's go forward because it's 2024 and we really know a lot more about neuroscience and the body and the power of language and what works and what doesn't work. And one of your contributors, Elvira Lang Anderson, has Comfort Talk, and I did an interview with her. I know she's a major figure in our field teaching clinicians and doctors. But why don't you walk us through all of the major themes, and in our blog, we will list the titles of all the chapters. This is a monster book, but if you want to know the state of the art, this is the book to get. Why don't you help us?
Happy to. When we first started thinking about what our contribution would be in this book, because I was working with people who are very familiar with the research, who have a foot in medicine and the work that they do, the Lauren Sugarman, Giuseppe De Beneditis, and Catalin Varga have also offered some very important theoretical orientations to the field. I wanted someone who was brand new, who knew nothing at all about hypnosis, to know something about its history and its foundation. So we did a whole first section that did a historical overview that addressed the theoretical models that people are using and also transitioned to This is a art of the practice, mm-hmm. that our creativity very much has a impact on how one uses the set of skills. Then we did a section that brought the research up to date on the Neuroscientific Foundation and, you know, the understanding of neuroplasticity. While many people can't begin to name all the different parts of the brain, we now have a better idea of what's going on inside the brain when someone is experiencing what we would call hypnosis. Mm-hmm. Better way of defining what trance means. And this is very important because the history of hypnosis for many people got mixed in with the mystery and magic.
Well said. Not,
yeah,
not, mesmer.
Not
and,
always.
Yeah.
Yeah, not always for people's well-being.
Right.
So it carried some stigma, but I think what we were able to do in the neuroscientific section of the book is say, this is a skill in everybody. This mm-hmm. is ubiquitous. Not everybody knows that about themselves, but and can it be misused? Yes, but there's so many ways in which we can use it positively. Then we went through all of the most prominent areas of clinical hypnosis practice, that it's used in dermatology very, very successfully. We address development because people don't realize when you're rocking a baby and the rhythm of that is soothing and creates its own kind of opportunity for mm-hmm. The body learning how mm-hmm. to use its self-regulating abilities. And we went through each of these areas, fibromyalgia, the latest research is in there on that, and went into some of the more challenging areas, use in surgery, oncology. You mentioned childbirth. You know, I was about 4 months ago lucky enough to be with my daughter when she had her first baby, and all of the nurses were trained in hypnobirthing.
Great.
Which I was delighted to know about, and she had a very, very difficult delivery, but wanted me by her side. And afterward, the nurses all said, "You had the best suggestions. We've learned so much from you."
I bet.
So it was very, very exciting. And then in the very final section of the book, we wanted to look forward. And mm-hmm. what does this mean? And our hope that all of the editors shared was that more people would be familiar with what we mean by clinical hypnosis and the very, very many ways it could be integrated into practice mm-hmm. in medicine. You know, we've know a lot about placebo effect. People are familiar with that. They're not so familiar with the nocebo effect.
Right, which is the negative version of negative suggestions. Yeah, go on.
Exactly. You know, you go in for surgery and you're signing your life away. This doesn't exactly get people into the mindset you want for a positive outcome.
Right.
I'm reminded when I was training a bunch of doctors who were using hypnosis, one of the surgeons said how hard it was for her to get the right kind of music in the surgical room, that they were playing some heavy metal stuff that was saying things like, "I want to die, I want to die." And she said, "Yeah, we can't have this in the surgical operating theater. And she worked hard on that. And I thought, this is something everybody in medical school ought to be learning about and know about, these, the impact all of this has on people. So in our frontiers, we also took a very systemic focus. We wanted to look at the community at large and what it means to integrate all of this knowledge and skills in the various areas of society. You know, it's mindfulness took off over the last decade, and you know, athletic teachers in schools are having kids focus and see themselves performing gymnastics and basketball and whatever beautifully. And it's a little bit of, you know, hypnotic suggestion at work there. And
a lot
wonderful.
Of it, performance, you know, enhancing states.
Absolutely. But there's so many things we could be doing without it being psychotherapy, but but still in terms of well-being. And again, with younger kids, we talk about their learning self-regulation, learning about the embodied mind.
Yes.
So it was the book is has a very, very, very wide scope in terms of all of that. And
So, Julie, I for my lay listeners, I realize after we've gotten into the book and everything, what is the latest definition of hypnosis, or what can we say to the public? Because I think a lot of people still think of a stage hypnotist or somebody swinging a watch, and this is not what we're talking about. But give us your wisdom on, for the layperson, what is hypnosis or trance states?
Well, you know, there's an agreed definition that researchers use, but I don't think it captures fully what the layperson needs to understand about hypnosis. It's a naturally occurring phenomenon that we can harness and guide to improve one's neuroplasticity. The brain keeps growing and changing. We all do throughout our life. The possibilities are enormous. And when we have experiences that absorb us and our attention, for example, people in prayer can be fully absorbed. People who are in survival mode are fully absorbed. Unfortunately, the soldier who has to go out and defend his country, his people, is in their own absorbed hypnotic state as part of their own survival mode. So it's complicated, I think, for the lay public to fully appreciate that. The skill is on a continuum.
Yes.
But within all of us. And it's not sleep, which is the origin of its Greek name. But we're certainly starting to appreciate which of the when you do an EEG, which of the brain waves are probably active during this attentive, absorbed state.
Right. It's an active concentration, really, and absorption, as you say. It's definitely not sleep. And when people go in the zone, They can perform at extraordinary levels, whether they're writing a book or they're playing piano or doing sports. And when their mind chatter starts doubting and things in their performance, they lose that absorptive quality. But from my work, what I try to say to people is, you know, those states are great, but you have to be in control of them. Because when you're in that state, someone with ulterior motives or agendas, it's easier to bypass your defense mechanisms and install like conspiracy theories or phobias or other malevolent beliefs. So,
well, you know, as human beings, you know, we're very much influenced by one another. And as we've come to understand mirror neurons, it's easy to get caught up in the event, whether it's in the concert where you're enjoying, you know, right, wonderful musicians, or in a more nefarious setting. And right, I think of some of the stories we've all heard in the news about clans, cults that, mm-hmm, you know, have been destructive. So yeah, that ability to be centered and aware and learning critical thinking to go along with this skill is immensely important.
Right. So on a personal note, let me tell my listeners, for me, learning how to control my mind and my imagination and use this skill has been, it's really I consider it my superpower, because people say, how could you do this work for 47 years? How do you have the energy, you know, with dealing with so many traumatized people? It's so, you know, it is difficult, but I have my recordings on my little iPod Nano of previous therapy sessions with Max Shapiro or Rebecca Johnston, Dan Brown, other luminaries. And then there were commercial tapes of helping you to go to sleep, you know, a time to relax your body and just guiding your mind out of that, you know, worry thoughts or you know, the things that would wake me up in the middle of the night. Now, if I need it, if I can't just do the deep breathing and relax, then I put it on, and it really has helped me tremendously. And I was thinking, or more recently, I had a hip replacement surgery. So I saw a clinical psychologist who did hypnosis, and she was having me visualize walking and running smoothly and safely, etc. Anyway, please, Julie, you were going to say something.
Well, as you were talking about your own experience of explaining things to people, what was going through my mind is I'm not sure what word to use. Our curiosity, mm-hmm, about who we are is teaching us something about dissociative abilities. And mm-hmm, and people are on a continuum, right, with that. And we're starting to guess that there are, you know, or the way our brains develop over time, some people have better skills, mm-hmm, at sort of getting into their artwork or being, you know, out there running the marathon, which takes a certain amount of, as you put it, turning off some of that chatter, mm-hmm, that goes on, and you're just in the moment. Now, because going through trauma can create the same thing. That's why I mentioned survival mode before, because when you've been traumatized, you learn to distance. You have to in order to, right, survive. So And they may often be the people who are a little bit more vulnerable to the nefarious uses of hypnosis. It's a guess. It's a hypothesis. It's still being studied. What are all the effects that allow someone to be more vulnerable and have to learn how to get centered and question and stay enough in touch with reality association, right, as opposed to dissociating, so right, that they are truly, truly safe. I hope I said that well.
Yeah, it was very good. If I may, I'll just say what I've learned over 4 decades of working with my clientele predominantly is that I don't do hypnotherapy. I teach people about hypnosis and altered states. I teach them how to do it to themselves. And where I start is just that we are embodied minds and that you need to be in your body, in the here and now, with an internal locus of control to understand how the mind works, how the brain works, how social psychology works, how to discern trustworthy people from untrustworthy people and such, have a positive future orientation. And when it comes to past trauma, in the here and now, you're okay. It happened to the younger you. And to have them visualize that traumatic event in a dissociated way on a TV screen or whatever, I know you know all of this stuff, but just to, for my listeners, you see the younger you being traumatized. For example, when I fell asleep at the wheel of a Mooney van and drove into the back of a tractor trailer truck at 80 miles an hour, I was fully awake in those final seconds. And then I was in agony. But if I didn't put that younger Steve 47 years ago in a TV screen, I'd never be able to drive a car and be near an 18-wheeler on a highway. Like that, as the learning was, you need to sleep. Never drive if you're sleepy. Like I made that deal with myself. But the point is that I teach people how to process if they were in a cult and did all and given a new identity, to take who they truly are, helping them. And this is something I learned from Dan Brown, one of my main teachers, Daniel P. Brown. He said, you ask them, when do you feel the most you? When people are asking, I don't know who I am. I was raised in a cult and I had all these. Well, when I'm playing guitar, when I'm playing with children, when I'm, you know, whatever. But you start with that internal thing. And then you use that neuroplasticity to, once they have that education of what's normal, what's healthy, etc., I teach them to go back in time to how they got recruited, let's say. And I ask the simple question, if you knew then what you know now, what would you say and do differently? And then people are like, I tell them to go get lost. You know, I'd run that meeting. I'm like, yes, that's correct, because you didn't have informed consent. And I teach them how to process and rewire their cult identity to be aligned, taking the good stuff, because people do have good experiences, but to be fully embodied minds where they're deciding their destiny. And it works beautifully. And it's something that most people working with my population have no clue about. They're just not trained.
Well, you've integrated, you know, all of the understanding about how dissociation can be used to help change. This notion of it's now, that was then, this is now, is really, really important, because the intensity of traumatic experiences pulls us back into the experience.
Right.
And when we can stay grounded in the present, it's easier to get the distance and move on with your healthier life. I agree with you. Not enough people understand. I wrote a paper recently about how anybody who's working in child psychotherapy should be hypnosis informed.
Yes.
And probably I could say the same about any psychotherapy, not just with children, with adults too, and anybody working in a medical profession. We've certainly seen the wonderful work of Bessel van der Kolk, who started out, by the way, doing a lot of research with hypnosis.
I know Bessel, Body Keeps the Score is still selling a ton of books. Yeah.
Right. And teaching people about being trauma-informed and what its impact has been. And you mentioned Dan Brown, who it was brilliant, and talk about tomes put together, probably the most comprehensive volume on attachment and dissociation.
Yeah, I took took his workshops on adult attachment repair. His co-author of that award-winning book just produced a course, an online course for therapists, with some colleagues in Australia. So it's online if people want to understand more of Dan's stuff. Dan taught me so much, really, and got me hungry for forensics and just understanding the interface of the law. And of course, he co-authored Memory, Trauma, Treatment, and the Law with Alan Shefflin. Yeah. And God, I'm blocking on the third author. But anyway, we'll put the link in the blog of the third author of that tome. I know you've written
It was David Spiegel
It wasn't. Oh, God, no. I have the book, but it's in the other room.
It's okay.
I can almost visualize it, but it's not coming to me under this stress. But
the law has a very limited understanding of what hypnosis is, and I'm sure you know that as well as anyone.
Alan Shefflin wrote Trance on Trial about the problems of the law. Alan was another mentor and teacher of mine who said, stop calling it brainwashing, call it undue influence. It's a 300-year-old concept, etc. And he created a social influence model for expert witnesses that I included in my doctoral dissertation on how to update the law. I miss him dearly. And of course, he was a major figure. But let me just circle back. I guess I was going to ask you, because I know you've written on metaphors, therapeutic metaphors, if you might feel comfortable sharing a short metaphor with our listeners.
Because our minds are so oriented towards all the experiences we've ever had, any experience can be turned into a metaphor. I'm reminded of she was a 7-year-old girl, second grader, who woke up every morning with tummy aches. And you know, children, when they're upset about things, they don't have words for things. They often develop these functional symptoms. And I knew from the little things that she played in the play therapy office that school was stressful for her. And she wasn't sure how to handle some of the interactions with kids, was worried about doing well as a student. And I was standing next to her and I looked at her and I said, you know, I don't think the elevator's connected between your tummy and what you're thinking up here. Let's connect the elevator and get the elevator moving so those feelings can become words and you can tell us what's going on. All our tummy aches stopped.
Love it.
That was the suggestion I made. It's simple little metaphor.
Yep.
But it made a big difference. And when we develop metaphors, it's so important that they're related to experiences that are familiar for someone. So, you know, if it's simple, like imagine that you're floating on a cloud up in the sky, away from all the stresses and things that worry you, a little bit like if you were floating in the swimming pool, having a nice time tanning in the sun on your wonderful float, whatever. These take people to familiar experiences. So being up on the cloud, and then for people who are phobic about airplane flying, they become a bird up in the sky. And they fly wherever they need to, and they know exactly how to manage their way through the clouds and the wind and looking down on beautiful earth. They're simple.
Right.
And metaphors can be more complicated. We can take a whole story, and there are lots of parables and Mother Goose stories that are useful for
I seem to remember David Gordon wrote a book on therapeutic metaphors. Stephen Langton wrote a book, I believe, on enchantment, Tales of Enchantment. This is going back to the, I think, the 70s or the 80s. But we are storytelling beings, and that's how we make sense of reality. And if somebody is sharing a story, even a personal story, but it's tailored to match their need, and it's just this fundamental assumption that I learned from all my teachers, that the body wants to heal itself. You know, it's like if we really are listening, we can even have dialogues. So, hey, tummy, what is it that you want? You're trying to tell me. It's like, get out of that job. It's really, you know, it's not helpful.
That's right.
Right? So just that's listening and tuning in. And I'd like to share briefly, did you know Claire Fredericks, by any chance, psychiatrist? Claire Fredericks?
Oh, yeah, I knew Claire very well. Yes.
Ah, so she did Center Core Phenomenon, which it was a very unique frame that I had not been exposed to before. I attended a teaching with her, but it's the notion of that we have these parts of, you know, the creative you and the wise you, or the protector you. And you can call on this resource whenever you need to help you problem solve or help you navigate the different ups and downs of life. And this is a different version of parts therapy of Richard Schwartz and such, of getting in touch with this is like constructing or becoming aware of existing parts of your being that are just powerful resources to help you, you know, do your best. And,
you know,
amazing.
I think in various cultures, we have different ways of talking about those core competencies. I'm reminded of Teresa Robles, who has done incredible.
I know her too,
Mexico, and she refers to universal wisdom and our ability to tap in to the historical wisdom that, you know, is available to all of us, whether you think of that as genetic or learned or part of your culture, you know.
God.
People have different.
Or the divine.
Yes.
Right?
Well, yeah,
another way
people
of saying,
have different ways of of making sense of that. It's such a hopeful and helpful way to conceptualize, you know, the fact that we're not helpless victims.
Right.
Even when we've been victimized.
Yep. Yep. And I have to just say that I've been interviewed on your Undivided Attention podcast of the Center for Humane Technology a few years ago, and just the feeling that being online and getting into doom scrolling and such is like a hypnotic trance where you lose time and orientation. And the technology is directing you with algorithms that you're not choosing, and just the dangers of that, you know, because the big platforms want to monetize your attention so they can make more money selling you ads to buy things you don't necessarily want or need. And it's just something young people need to know about.
Keep in mind that, yes, that these very, very, very smart people who are putting together all these algorithms and
right.
setting stuff up absolutely understand how easy it is to get people in this absorbed state and take advantage of that. You know, when Eva Banyai, who's a historically famous researcher in Hungary, used to teach about hypnosis. She talked about late night television when people would be watching television at 2-3 o'clock in the morning and they were selling toasters.
Yeah.
And the joke was, how many toasters did you buy?
Yeah.
Because the repetition, more repetition, you really need this toaster. This is really a great, wonderful thing for you to have in your home.
Right.
All of the things we, and soothing and rhythmic, things we are taught as part of what absorbs people and gets their attention. She used to show the advertising and say, you know, the advertisers know what they're doing to get you to buy these things that you don't necessarily need. So it's very much a part of our electronic world, the screen world, and you know, the kids who can spend 48, 72 hours playing online video games are very much being affected by this.
And dopamine addiction as well. I think I had at least a few workshops with her over the years. You know, it's just making me hungry to go back to some of the international conferences that I enjoyed so much. I love to learn. That's another thing. Just helping people tune into that desire to be the best you and to have, you know, more and more
so
understandings
important.
And perspectives that are different from yours, and to have that exposure with different cultures and appreciating that this is a gift to be alive.
Yes. Well, there's a big congress coming up this June in Poland for the International Society. So maybe you'll get there.
I think Bernard Trinkle mentioned that to me, but I don't think I followed up with him. So you just reminded me. Bernard and I go way back as well. And he even had me come up to Rottweil to do a training for his students and such. This has been wonderful. It's so lovely to do this with you. I want to call people's attention to this book. It's not cheap, but you can get the PDF, and that's much more reasonable. But if you're starting out in your career, this is the book to buy. And I agree wholeheartedly with you, Dr. Linden, that really anyone who's interested in healthcare, particularly therapists, need to have a deeper appreciation of words, of language, of different forms of communication to bring out the best in our clients and our patients, to help them have as much control and influence over their own experience, and so they can live the best life they can. With that, you have last words. What else? Any parting words for our listeners?
We've covered a great deal, Steve, and I'm grateful to you for the work you do in the field addressing the undue influence and what we need to do to change that. I think we share the wish that integrating these positive hypnosis skills in, particularly in medicine, is needed. It's happening. It's more than it ever used to be, and we continue to get more and more physicians coming in for the training.
Good.
But I think it will really make a difference in people's lives if we're able to integrate it into healthcare.
Yeah, and to move away from just prescribing a pill to actually teach skills and tools that people can use and understand and feel empowered. So thank you very much for all your incredible contributions.
You're very welcome.
Yep, thank you.
You're very welcome.
That's it for today's episode of The Influence Continuum. I've been your host, Dr. Stephen Hassan. Theme music for the podcast is by Nasser Malik. To keep up to date with me and happenings that I think are important, please visit my website at freedomofmind.com. There you'll find in-depth articles about cults, mind control, and other relevant topics. You can also find me on Twitter and Instagram at CultExpert. If you want to develop a comprehensive understanding of these topics, I highly recommend my books, Combating Cult Mind Control, Freedom of Mind, and The Cult of Trump, in that order. These books are a culmination of 45 plus years of experience and will really help you grasp the complex web of undue influence. I have also launched a new 9-hour online course for anyone interested in a deep dive into issues related to recovering from undue influence in all forms. While this course is designed for clinicians, everyone can benefit. Remember, love is stronger than mind control. And thanks for listening.